Takže dostat před hanem stůlete. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Good morning, everybody. First things first, before I, so that I don't forget at the end, I have a bunch of catalogs here. It's the Omega Institute, Wisdom Publications, another Omega Institute, some other center for retreats, Open Center, New York City, and I'm still trying to push L.L. Bean's clothing, and shoes for crews, good sturdy shoes. So please, if you're interested in any of these, pick them up at the end. Okay, so today we'll be taking sutta number 48 in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is called the Kosambya Sutta. It's the sutta spoken near the city or at the city of Kosambi. And this sutta has a very different flavor, a very different purpose from the sutta that we studied over the past couple of weeks. Whereas that sutta, the Chulavedala, was concerned with a kind of subtle and deep analysis of points of dharma or of doctrine, this sutta is concerned largely with how to bring a community of people together to live in peace and harmony. Because the Buddha wasn't just an individual teacher who taught wandering ascetics who would then learn from him and then go off and live on their own. But the Buddha took a rather innovative step amongst the contemplatives of his period in that he established a full-fledged order or community. Monastic community. And you know, when you bring groups of people together with different backgrounds, different interests, different presuppositions, different ways of life, different social classes, you're bound to meet with conflicts, quarrels, disputes among them. So don't think that, you know, when people become monks or nuns, they go off and they live together in perfect harmony. But even in the Sangha during the Buddha's time, when there were so many noble ones, liberated, enlightened ones, there was still conflicts, quarrels, and disputes. And so the Buddha had to lay down principles of harmony to bring these people together so that they could live together as a community and cultivate the path together without becoming divided over issues that would create discord and disharmony. And during a certain part of the Buddha's teaching career, in the city of Kosambi, there broke out a dispute which became extremely bitter, extremely divisive. And it spread out from groups of monks until virtually the whole Sangha at Kosambi became embroiled in this dispute. And not only the monastics, but the monastics had different groups of lay supporters. And so the different lay supporters who were supporting the different monks also became involved in the dispute. And then even the devas, the Dharma protecting devas, became very disheartened with what was happening in the Sangha. And so this became a major challenge to the Buddha during his teaching career. And at one point, while this dispute was raging, even the Buddha, he tried to bring the monks together. He didn't succeed, and he just turned his back and walked off and went to live in solitude. He thought it's impossible to bring, or it's felt so difficult to bring these people together, that I'll just let them resolve the issue by themselves. And why did this great conflict break out? Not over differences of this vehicle or that vehicle, this vada or that vada, this doctrine or this or that doctrine, this way of meditation, that way of meditation. The whole conflict broke out over a little bit of water that they use in the latrine to wash the behinds after going to the toilet. Okay, how did this happen? You see, in India during the Buddha's time, even today, people after defecation, they don't use toilet paper, but they use the water to wash the back. And so the Buddha had laid down a certain regulation with the bucket. Usually a bucket is kept within the latrine, and there'll be a kind of tank outside that one fills up with water when one has to go to the toilet. And the Buddha laid down a regulation that when you finish in the toilet, you either fill a bucket up to the top, right up to the very top of the bucket, or else you completely empty it and turn it upside down so that insects don't get inside and, you know, drown in the little bit of water that might be left. Okay, but once one monk who is very learned in the Dhamma went to the toilet, and after finishing, he left the bucket with a little bit of water in it. Then right after him, another monk who is an expert in the Vinaya, the rules of discipline, went to the same latrine, and he saw the bucket of water with a little bit of the bucket with a little bit of water in it. So he inquired around who used the toilet just before I did, and then he learned that this very knowledgeable Dhamma master had used the toilet. So he went to him and said, "Do you know you're not supposed to leave water in the bucket when you finish? You have to either fill it and leave it for the next person or empty it completely." But the monk who is knowledgeable about the Dhamma thought, "Is this the case? No, I don't think that's the case at all." And so he refused to admit his offense. Then each of the monks went to their own community of pupils and told them what had happened. And then the pupils of the Vinaya master, the discipline master, thought, "How can that monk be so learned in the Dhamma, and yet he doesn't know the simple rule of procedure when using the toilet?" And so his followers became upset with the Dhamma master. Then the pupils of the Dhamma master heard that the Vinaya master was criticizing their teacher, and so they became upset with the Vinaya master and his pupils. And so then the two groups started to quarrel. It's a transgression of the rules to leave the water. No, it isn't. It is. It isn't. It is. It isn't. And then each group spoke to the other monks, and each one tried to form alliances with other groups of monks, until everybody had an opinion about the matter, divided into like almost these two bitterly hostile, bitterly antagonistic groups of monks. Then the monks went to their lay followers and said, "You know, this group is criticizing us. We should turn against them and try to straighten them out." And so in this way, the quarrel, the conflict, just built, gained momentum. And even when the Buddha stepped into the midst of the Sangha and tried to resolve it, the monk said, "Master, you should be just teaching us the Dhamma, but you don't get involved in these matters." You know, it's a little bit like, you know, this is a matter, you're supposed to be the great spiritual giant, so let us settle this quarrel by ourselves without you sticking your nose into this matter. Okay, so this is what is the background to the famous quarrel at Kosambi. And so the sutta opens, it says, "Now, on that occasion, the monks at Kosambi had taken to quarreling and brawling and were deep in disputes, stabbing each other with," the Pali actually uses the phrase, "the swords of their tongues." And then one group couldn't convince the other, or couldn't persuade the other. And so in this way, the quarrel continued. Okay, so then when the Buddha heard about this, he called the monks to his presence, and then he asked them, "Is it true that you've taken to the quarrels and disputes?" And then they said, "Yes, Venerable Sir." And then the Buddha asked them, "When you take to quarrels, the quarreling and brawling, and are deep in disputes, stabbing each other with the swords of your tongues, on that occasion do you maintain acts of loving kindness by body, speech, and mind, in public and in private, towards your companions in the spiritual life?" And so they say, "No." Okay, and then the Buddha upbraids them and says, at the end of paragraph 5, he says, "Misguided men, this will lead to your harm and suffering for a long time." And then the Buddha sets out to teach them what are called the 6 principles of cordiality. Well, these are the 6 principles of harmony. I think even in Chinese Buddhism, they have this liu, he, fa, right? 6, liu, 6, he, harmony, fa, principles. So these are the 6 principles of cordiality or harmony that create love and respect and lead to cohesion, to non-dispute, to concord, and to unity. What are the 6? Okay, first, a monk maintains bodily acts of loving kindness towards his friends or companions in the holy life, both in public and in private. So this is the first principle of harmony that leads to love and respect and conduces to cohesion, non-dispute, concord, and unity. Okay, then the second principle is going to be maintaining verbal acts of loving kindness. And the third principle is maintaining mental acts of loving kindness. And so, you know, we have this word metta that we use very often. You know, even whenever we write a letter or email, we say, "with metta." But often you think metta means just doing a kind of meditation. But here we have 3 ways of acting. All of them are qualified as ways that are governed by loving kindness. So the Pali actually uses the expression, "Mettam palayakama." Okay, so usually before one starts to, can you see? It's mettang, kaya kammang, then again metta vachi kammang, and metta mano kammang. So usually one starts by arousing a thought of loving kindness towards another person, in this case of monks living together, and then one can do something bodily, some kind of bodily action. For example, if there's an older monk and a junior monk, then the junior monk might sweep out the room or the cottage of the older monk. But the younger monk might prepare some tea for the older monk. Or they don't have to be older or younger, but one monk can prepare tea for the other. But usually it's the younger monk does some service for the older monk, if there's a big age difference between them. Or if one of the monks is ill, then one could go to the dhanasala, the refectory or kitchen, and get some food and bring it back for the sick monk. So like over the past few months, Venerable Kema Ratana here, he's been staying with me in Taishu Hall. So especially during the cold days of the winter, early in the morning, even when it was dark, not yet fully light, when it's time for breakfast. So a lazy Bhante decides to stay back in Taishu Hall, and Venerable Kema Ratana brings back the tiffin carriers with the breakfast for me, and then he'll clean out my humidifier and refill it with water and fill up the flask for the boiling the water for tea for me. So this is, you could say, a kaya kama, mettang kaya kama. Now when it says public, it doesn't mean that one does it before a large crowd, but you do it openly so other people can see. But sometimes you could do something that's called in private, which means a little bit secretly. Like maybe if the other monk goes away on a trip, you arrange things in order in this room. Well, actually, this is a case of public, but we have a few of the people that come to the Saturday class. Usually every other week they come to my room in Taishu Hall and they do a mettang kaya kammang. For me, they vacuum the rugs and clean the tables and the bathrooms. So that's a kind of open kaya kammang, open deed of loving kindness. But we could also do that privately or sort of secretly. Like, it's a way of not trying to get any credit for oneself, but when the other person is not aware, you do something beneficial to them, helpful to them. Okay, so this is a way of expressing loving kindness openly and also privately. Any examples you could think of from your own day-to-day life? You know, this isn't just for relations between monks or between monks and nuns, but even in the family life, for a husband and wife to get along, what can they do? Yeah.
My husband, I had a spoiled lease in one of my tires, so my husband put air in the tire for me this morning.
Maybe take the microphone.
I have a slow leak in one of the tires of the car. And so this morning, my husband put air in the tire for me. And I actually stood and watched him and allowed myself to feel gratitude towards him.
Feel
love and kindness towards him.
Yeah.
So
that's
nice.
There is no bucket in my home's toilet, but the toilet paper is always there.
Yeah.
I think someone put it in.
Oh, I see. You mean you never see it run out?
Yes.
Okay, so even... Did you have your hand up, Richard?
There's a wonderful poem by Robert Hayden in which he's reflecting on the fact that his father always used to wake up early on Sunday mornings and polish his shoes as well as his own. Mm-hmm. And he's remorseful thinking about his ingratitude to his father.
Yeah.
The last line of the poem is, what did I know? What did I know? Of love's austere and lonely offices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very good. Okay, so you could say that parents are always performing deeds of loving kindness for their children, usually openly, but on Christmas there's a kind of secret deed of loving kindness when the children come down and then they see under the tree piles of presents, and then they think Santa Claus is... The children are told that Santa Claus has left them here. So then the children are grateful to Santa Claus. Okay, so then comes verbal deeds of loving kindness, both in public and in private. Okay, we could say that this means when one is associating with other people, one speaks to them gently, politely, in a friendly way. One speaks to them in a way that will make them feel good, not praising them, you know, in a kind of artificial or not praising them, not flattering them, but speaking to them in a very polite and gentle and friendly way, in a way that will create harmony. Is that person ill in the back? Are you not feeling well? Okay, it's better to sit up when listening rather than to lie down, unless you're ill. Okay, and then verbal acts which are performed privately or secretly, what would you think that consists of? Any ideas? Neil, did you have something?
I don't know if this would be private. I don't know if this would quite be privately, but you know, say at work, if a coworker did something really well or something really nice, and then you let their boss know that they had, you know, done something without necessarily letting them know that you did that.
Yeah, that's a very good example.
When I was teaching, students would come and ask for letters of recommendation, which were generally supposed to be confidential. And, you know, you would write letters of recommendation and say good things about them to the schools that they were applying to or whatever.
Yeah.
And it was private.
Yeah. Okay, what if one sees somebody towards whom one has friendly feelings doing something bad or wrong? Does one always have to praise them and speak well of them?
To point that out with loving kindness.
Exactly.
I'm a psychotherapist, and so I'm often in that position where I might be speaking, and I work at an agency, so it's a group treatment program, so there's opportunities for my patients to engage in unskillful behaviors.
Yeah.
So then I see it as my responsibility to point that out to them, but really with love.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, so if one's, just to generalize, if one sees somebody doing something wrong and then one wants to help them, then one should set up first the mind of loving kindness and then speak to them, you know, privately and with the thought of benefiting them and helping them. You know, but usually when people see one person doing things, something badly, what is the sort of natural inclination of the mind? What is the natural inclination?
Aversion.
Aversion, but then what do they do once the...
Criticize.
To the person privately with the mind of loving kindness?
Not usually.
So what do they usually do?
Usually it's more public with, well, not with loving kindness.
Yeah.
Because usually we join on to that note, including them.
Yeah. Yeah. Usually we engage in something called backbiting. Yeah. Did you see what that fellow did? You know, it's shameful, disgraceful. Okay, so these are verbal acts of loving kindness, both in public and in private. And then the third one is mental acts of loving kindness, both in public and in private. I have to say, I think that the expression here, both in public and in private, doesn't seem to work so well with mental acts. Because the mental act, naturally, it's a private process.
Well, except, for example, like in my meditation group at home, if someone has an ill relative, we'll do a meta-meditation together for that relative. You know, just sit and...
I see.
And, you know, with thoughts of metta. So it's mental, but it's also public.
Okay, maybe that's a bit of an example. But usually we think of the mental act of loving kindness as being predominantly a private matter. I think perhaps it's even possible that the formula just came to be applied to all three of them in the same way. I don't know. Do you have any idea about that?
Well, I think having lived in community, you know, you can practice metta bhava, you know, in your kriti alone, but then as you're interacting with people in the community, to maintain that same...
Okay, that's a good example too. Okay, so the first three principles of harmony and respect are based on, all three of them based on loving kindness applied to the three modes of action, bodily action, verbal action, mental action. And so this, we say that these principles apply to any kind of community, any kind of group or organization or group. When you bring people together, what you have to, in order to maintain the harmony of that group, one has to encourage all of the members to act, speak, and think motivated by loving kindness, which means to wish for the benefit and happiness of all of the members and for the group as a whole. Okay, now we come to the fourth principle of harmony and respect. This is that the monk uses things in common with his virtuous companions in the spiritual life without making reservations, so without holding back, without discrimination and bias, but he shares with them any gain of a kind that's been righteously obtained, that's been obtained in accordance with the Dharma, even the mere contents of his alms bowl. And so we have a principle in the Sangha that, you know, whatever is provided to the Sangha should be shared ideally equally with everybody. And so, like, yesterday at lunchtime, a bag of these kind of crackers had been offered to the monastics, and then Venerable Jishu, she was distributing them to all of the monastics at lunchtime. And then she came to me and she was giving to me, and I don't care for them so much. So I said, I don't really care for them. But she said, I have to give. She used the Chinese expression, bu xiao bu duo, not too little, not too much. So everybody has to get the same amount. So if you don't like them, you can just, you know, put them aside or give them to others. But when distributing, everything should be shared equally. So you can say that the Sangha, it's being recorded, the ideal communist society with a small c, you know, not based on violence, not on totalitarian government, not on state control, but in theory or principle, it's everything gets shared equally, or you could say from each according to his ability, to each according to his need, from each according to his ability, and to each according to his needs. And so, like when I was living in Sri Lanka in this monastery, all of the monks, we used to go on alms round, and then when we would come up from the alms hall, then we would put the contents of the bowl, of whatever we wanted, we would keep for ourselves, but everything else we would put out on bowls on the table, and then the other monks can take from the table whatever they want. So in this way, all of the food gets shared with everybody. Okay, so that is the fourth principle. This maybe it's a little difficult to apply perfectly in civilian, secular life. But I would say one could give it a moderated application by holding that nobody should get too much of the material benefits produced by a society, and nobody should be deprived of the essentials of a healthy life. So everybody should be provided with sufficient food, housing, medical care, and the opportunity to earn a living in order to provide for themselves and their families. And so when we have the social order, which is becoming increasingly polarized, where the wealth is getting channeled in greater concentration to the top, and people in the great support of the pyramid are constantly losing their wealth through unemployment, housing foreclosures, excessive taxation, and now cutting social benefits. This, we could say, is moving in the opposite direction from that implied by this particular guideline that the Buddha laid down. Okay, then we come to the fifth principle of harmony and respect. Here, the monk dwells both in public and in private, possessing in common with his fellows in the spiritual life those virtues. Here the word is sila, the guidelines of proper conduct, that are unbroken, untorn, unblotched, unmottled, which are liberating, praised by the wise, which are not wrongly grasped, and which are conducive to concentration. And so with this principle, the Buddha is emphasizing the fact that all of the monastics who are living together in the community have to be guided by, in this case, the monastics, the rules of the monastic order. And so when some monks are violating the essential rules and others are observing, then it leads to disharmony and to the arising of factions within the community. And so the Buddha laid down the rules in order to establish certain guidelines to good conduct within the monastic order. And so all of the monastics are obliged to observe these rules. And then these rules are said to be freeing and conducive to concentration, to samadhi. And we could also give this an extended application to society at large. Maybe we can't say that everybody has to observe the Buddha's precepts exactly the way they're observed by Buddhists. But if we take the main Buddha's precepts, say the five precepts, not killing, not stealing, not engaging in sexual misconduct, not speaking falsehood, and not using intoxicants or intoxicating substances, then we could see that these five principles will promote a harmonious society. Doesn't that seem to be the case? Anything else that's missing from these five guidelines that should be included? Maybe take the microphone.
These are all nots. I think it should be a should.
Okay, that's good. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And how would you give some examples of that?
Helping a person across the street who seems confused.
Okay. Yeah.
I don't know. Helping a friend in the hospital.
Something the hospital hasn't thought about.
But doing something.
Yeah. Okay, but I think we could say that all of these active ways of conduct can be comprised under mettaṃ kayakamaṃ, loving bodily acts, loving verbal acts, loving mental acts.
Right. Well, but you're listing these precepts.
Well, the five precepts are expressed negatively as abstaining from this. But often when the Buddha gives a fuller account of the principles of ethical conduct, he'll balance the prohibition aspect with, you might call, the injunction aspect, what one should do. So one abstains from killing, instead one dwells kind and compassionate towards all living beings. One abstains from stealing, and instead one lives honestly, not depriving others of their belongings. And in fact, not stealing, you could also say, is counterbalanced by generosity. Not engaging in sexual conduct, but maintaining some kind of restraint and sobriety. Not speaking falsehood, but speaking the truth, especially when it's necessary to speak the truth in order to promote the well-being of the society. And I think if people avoid the use of intoxicants, I don't want to say that it has to be prohibited absolutely through a whole society, but if they avoid using, alcohol to the point of intoxication, a lot of the crimes that follow from drunkenness, including the deaths and injuries that come from drunken driving, could be avoided. Any other examples? Richard? Yeah, maybe if you pass the microphone back.
Yeah. The clearest one, I think, is the fourth, the sharing one. The first, second, and third, the problem is, they could be listed as one. You could say bodily, verbal, and mental acts.
Yeah.
And the only... they are so broad that I wonder, you could do any of them and do nothing else. That is, you could devote your life to just doing bodily acts of loving kindness or just praising everybody and doing nice verbal things, right? And you could forget about the rest, which there's plenty to do. There's an infinite number of things that can fit into any of those categories. The problem is they're kind of limitless. The fifth one strikes me as kind of undefined, because It's virtues, but it doesn't tell you what the virtues are. It just tells you that they're unbroken, untorn, unblotched, unmodeled, liberating, commended, not misapprehended, and conducive to concentration. But it doesn't list the
virtues. Oh, of course, because this is just sort of laying out a general formula for the monks, and the monks will know it. In this case, they will know what those rules are, what those principles of virtue are, because they will be familiar with them from many other discourses of the Buddha.
Right, and then the sixth one is right view.
I haven't come to that yet. But go on, say what you wanted to say.
Well, again, that one, like the fifth and sixth, but it seemed extremely broad to me.
I think what we have to understand is that the people who are being addressed will know from their exposure to previous teachings of the Buddha what is being referred to.
Yeah.
In every discourse, the Buddha can't repeat whole large categories of teachings, which he's given on other occasions. Okay. David, back in the back.
I'm struck. Somebody once wrote a book, I don't know who wrote it, it was Everything I Need to Know I Learned in Kindergarten. And I'm thinking that a lot of this is the kind of thing that you would teach kindergarten children.
Yeah.
You know, to be nice and to share and not to say nasty things and stuff like that. So it's at that level.
Yeah.
So it's a lifetime kind of lesson that one learns. The other thing is that these things all seem to be part of that eightfold path. They're very related, are they not? Right view, right attention, right speech, right action.
Yeah, of course there are like close connections between them, though.
I was wondering if that's what he was trying to get them to think about or to get back to.
I don't think in this case that the Buddha is specifically trying to expound the Eightfold Path in an indirect way. Because the Eightfold Path, let's say in the Eightfold Path, the emphasis is pretty much on one's own individual practice, even though some of those factors involve how one relates to other people, like right speech, right action, right livelihood, particularly. But here the Buddha is laying these down more as guiding principles for people who are existing in a community which has already been established, and to show them how they should behave in relation to others in order to preserve and promote the harmony of that community, and so that all of the members of that community will be contributing to the well-being of the other members as well as to the cohesion of the group as a whole. Okay, then I just want to come to the last of these, the sixth of these, which has already been alluded to. So the monk dwells both in public and in private, possessing with his companions in the spiritual life that view that is noble and emancipating and leads one who practices in accordance with it to the complete destruction of suffering. So here the Buddha, as you mentioned, doesn't specify what the content of that view is. But from other occasions, the monks will know pretty much that it's referring to things like especially the view of the Four Noble Truths, and then the subordinate aspects of that, or other principles connected with it, the three characteristics, dependent origination. So this is the view is called noble, because it's the view which is especially characteristic of the noble person. Person who's reached one of the degrees or stages of enlightenment. It's emancipating, niyanika, it leads outwards to liberation, and then it leads one who practices in accordance with it to nibbana, here called the complete destruction of suffering. So in other words, for the Sangha to hold together as a group, all of the members have to be in harmony in acknowledging and revering the view based on the Four Noble Truths, dependent origination, the three marks of existence. In a way, this principle is difficult to apply to a society of multicultural, multi-religious, multicultural, multi-religious society. Because in a society, people will have, naturally, will have different views. But what principle can we propose to hold a society together, a large civilian society?
Tolerance.
Exactly, that's exactly the word I was thinking about. Tolerance and respect for other views and for those who hold other views. So that one will respect the freedom of others to believe as they feel inclined to believe and to practice in accordance with their beliefs. But should there be any limits on that tolerance? But what if I follow a religion or religious system which requires human sacrifice on a particular day of the year? Every day I'm obliged to sacrifice a child, not from my own family, but from another family. Of course, we can't allow that. Any other thoughts about this principle? Yvonne?
I think this is only possible in theory, not possible in practice.
Yeah.
How do you tolerate the culture that practices intolerance? Do you tolerate a culture that practices intolerance?
I would say that one has to... I mean, this is more a matter for legal scholars than for a monk to comment on. But the way I would address that is by saying that, okay, if somebody is intolerant, of course one has to allow them to they can disparage the views and religions of others verbally. One can't prohibit them from doing that, but one should prohibit them from taking any kinds of act, from acting in any way which will prevent others from practicing in accordance with their faith, with their beliefs. For example, burning down the churches or temples of others, prohibiting people of a different religious belief from publishing and distributing their religious literature. Prohibiting others of different religious beliefs from preaching and expounding their teachings.
I understand what you're saying. It's just the current case about the Fifth Amendment right.
Yeah.
Actually, it's
the
First Amendment right. Upheld. I understand the principle behind it, but as a society, are we saying that only bodily harm is harm? Verbal harm is not harm. Are we saying that while we're saying that parents should not mentally abuse their children, it's much harder to prove that.
Yeah.
And so I think all these are nice in theory, but in practice, it's not. I don't think it's possible to really practice this idea.
Yeah. Anyway, this is a matter that will require discussion. Now I'm going to have to conclude the class today a little bit earlier because today is the new moon day, and so the nuns will come and they will perform the offering ritual. And so we'll have to end today. And then right after the lunch, I have to go to the airport to go to California, and so we won't be able to have a discussion group today. But we'll have our next class. I think it's March 26th, and so we'll deal with the second part of the sutta on March 26th. Okay, so let us end with the sharing of the merits. So I will go directly into the recitation. Akasa ta chakumata deva naga mahitika punyanta nanumodipa shirang rakantu sasanam. Akasa ta chakumata deva naga mahitika punyanta nanumodipa shirang rakantu desanam. Akasa ta chakumata Deva naga mahitika punyanta nanumodipa shiram rakantu mam param. Eta vatacham hehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe deva numodantu sabbe bhuta numodantu sabbe sadanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya Pabhagupadaya vichitato etantare satakai upapanna rupi arupicha sanya sanino dukha pabhuchantu pulsantu vibhuti. Okay, we can stand and end with three bows to the Buddha.
Out of body.